committee to come to the conclusion that there's sufficient abuse that the state needs a right to appeal it.
My feeling would be to just leave it alone for the time being. There's no
right concern. I agree with that.
Now, let's go back to the deleted language.
Yeah, I just, on that, Mr. Chairman, I am still of the opinion that we've done the correct thing, that there, at least for most items, when a person pleads guilty, my criminal work stopped a few years ago, but they usually sign a petition to change their plea, and in that they state they understand what's involved in any negotiations, and then after the plea is accepted and the sentence is entered, we've signed another form. I think there was a waiver of the right to appeal. I mean, you couldn't do that. It wouldn't be a waiver of right to appeal. It's a notice of one's right to appeal. You sign and accept it within 30 days, and very little is accomplished by those appeals. I'm satisfied with that. And the only thing that Stevie has raised is that if you had a substantial dollar amount of restitution or some other thing, coupled with the sentence, which is within the statutory maximum, that you have no immediate redress of that issue. And I don't know that that would be a proper subject for post-conviction relief. If it can be reached by post-conviction relief, then the whole thing holds together, it seems to me.
Then why don't you make a note?
I'm reasonably comfortable to leave the deleted language.
Let's make a note to check that further. The draft is back before us.
Could I ask a question about where we're at right here on this?
Mm-hmm.
Think about someone that is convicted in a trial before the judge or a jury, and their only issue on appeal is the same issue that a person who's pled guilty's issue on appeal is, this is cruel and unusual punishment. Why are we letting that person go forward and not the one that's pled guilty?
Chairman Lauber, in the point, they still have their constitutional rights of appeal if they're going to raise a constitutional ground.
They would just raise a something procedural in the trial or something.
Well, no, I think that probably one on habeas corpus or a similar proceeding.
Yeah.
Some post-conviction relief if they want to raise a, see that they can bring it up to the level of constitutional violation, I think they can always do that.
I was more curious why we weren't cutting off this right to appeal to someone that has a trial and only wants to appeal on cruel and unusual punishment grounds. The sentencing, you know, you gave the tenant for a Class B felony or something. But I suppose they could get around that by just appealing on some evidentiary issue and also appealing on the cruel and unusual punishment.
That's right.
I think the task force in the interim came to the same conclusion as this policy advocates. Glenn, do you recall, didn't this come out of the task force?
We had a similar notion about guilty plea appeals, but had allowed, if there were another issue to be appealed, another issue that was otherwise appealable, then they could bring up, I'm trying to remember what all they could bring up, but they weren't going to have to always go post-conviction. If they had another appeal issue, they could bring up a constitutional issue or the statutory excessive. I can't remember now, but I know we took out statutory excessive sentence in some context. I just don't remember exactly how, where they were permitted to appeal. Um, Michael. I sort of see two, if I'm reading this correctly now, another issue that occurs to me, unless I'm misreading it, is that you've got 138.040 says, establishes that a defendant can appeal to the Court of Appeals from a district or circuit court conviction, and it's any defendant. And then it says, including where the court imposes cruel and unusual, whatever. As I understand it, the only the rights to appeal are provided in the statute. Otherwise, there's not any absolute right of appeal to the Court of Appeals. And that if you eliminate where we have language on line 25, I guess my question is, have we eliminated altogether right to appeal of those who are guilty or no contest, pleas, all rights to appeal to the Court of Appeals, or just the right for those persons to go a statutory excessive sentence appeal?
I don't know whether Jerry Cooper might be of any assistance to us on that question or not.
I had a statute. Well, I had a case like this. The fellow was convicted. I didn't represent him at trial, but he was plea bargained and shot his friend with a shotgun and killed him. He was plea bargained to a Class C felony and he was sentenced to 5 years in penitentiary. And I was appointed to, he fired his attorneys. And I was appointed by the court to represent him on an appeal. And my research showed that his only appealable issue was that the punishment was cruel and inhumane. And
was or was
that
not?
It was that it was cruel and inhumane to sentence him to 5 years for that particular act. And that was affirmed without opinion. And the way I understand it, that's all they ever do. That there's
right.
A judge sentencing within the within the statutory limits. They're not going to they're going to uphold those. Or there's no, I understand there are no cases that in which the judges the appeals courts have reversed the trial court. But you do have, it was a couple of years ago, so I can't recall, but that was the only basis for appeal. And there was, I can't remember if it's statutory or constitutional, but it was, you did have that right of appeal, even though you had pled guilty.
Let's bring Bill Gary back over here when we have our final work session to go over this portion. This is really authored initially by Gary, and I'd like to get him here so we can go through it. Anything further on those sections right now? Okay, let's turn to the next issue, which is conditional discharges. That completes the issues in the bill other than sentencing findings, which we'll come back to in a moment, but I'd like to go on with a couple of the other issues that aren't in the bill at the moment, and that is the conditional discharges issue. Would you like to come up from your division?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Lee Gerloff, Chief of Release Services. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. My persistence is only exceeded by my frustration with the particular condition of conditional discharges. I have been sort of hounding Linda concerning what we're going to dispense, if we are indeed going to dispense.
Excuse me, I can't hear you. Yes, thank you.
Is working?
Yeah.
Better?
Yes.
We've been dealing with a conditional discharge for a period of about a year and a half at this point. And my major concern is that what we have developed with that particular status It's sort of a bureaucratic nightmare. We go through basically the same kind of procedure for revoking a person on that status that occurs when you revoke someone on parole. The responsibility for the supervision falls to the field as well. And I think our position at this point is that this doesn't really serve a useful purpose. Most of the people on that status are your short-term property offender. They are not revoked unless they commit a new crime and would then generally be faced with doing additional time as well. So what we are requesting is that that is spoken to in 421.120, Section 3. And we're only asking that that section be repealed and then deal with the supervision of all inmates who go through the institutions through the parole process rather than the conditional discharge process.
Are we going to need some further provision that assures they will be under parole? Wasn't this?
I think that that this? Provision could be dealt with by the parole board rules, just requesting that there be everyone be released under a supervisory kind of period, as opposed to letting them serve to their good time date and then requesting supervision for 6 months on their good time as opposed to parole time.
If I remember correctly, the committee originally looked at the bill you introduced that would have simply repealed the conditional discharge provisions of the present law. My recollection of the committee's reaction to that was not favorable. By the same token, however, we were talking about trying to move in the direction of getting at the problem by way of requiring that all of those inmates would come under some period of or structure of supervision, get it
yes.
that way.
Yes.
Which I guess is what you're talking about now.
Actually, yes. Rather than developing an entirely different process for dealing with that type of an inmate.
If there's no objection, I'll ask Linda to work with the division in developing a language that would do that for inclusion in the redraft of the bill.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next issue is whether or not the statute dealing with the promulgation of the matrix should include a specific reference to consider correctional facility capacity, setting the matrix. Not in the bill, but that's an issue that has been presented to the committee. Whether or not the factors that the board is directed to take into account in setting the matrix are to include, especially to include institutional capacity. Mr. Lamar?
I guess I have a problem in saying that ought to be the policy determination or policy ingredient up front. It's almost something I could rather see handled at the other end. Either administratively or by statute, says that when we reach a certain level, this triggers a certain happening, or gives the parole board the authority to do such and such. But since the space situation, well, certainly for a number of years it hasn't been anything but crowded, so I guess it is ever present, but I wonder if you ever got the situation where you found that you had enough facilities or alternatives so that you didn't have the crowding that you had right now, that having plugged that into a matrix system, I have a hard time figuring out how you'd work it. Are you suggesting that, or is the suggestion that it somehow be used to reduce the time period for
all classifications or just some classifications, or that it be used in individual cases to reduce time? How would that fit into a matrix determination?
Well, I think it would ripple into the determination of the ranges, whether that would be for all offenses or not. I suppose it would be a matter the board would have to resolve. Representative Hill?
I agree with Representative Lombard. I think when you're evaluating this, you're looking at an individual in an individual situation. And it would seem to me that the overcrowding problem is one that is general. And I guess I would like to see the board stay focused on the individual at this point and just deal with the overcrowding problem in a more general way. So I guess I would agree with Representative Lombard. I would like to see it addressed, but not in that place.
Okay, well, the committee may, I think, have the opportunity within the next few days to look at proposed legislation that would deal with a mechanism for addressing overcrowding on an ongoing basis. There was a draft ready for the committee to consider introducing for purpose of hearings. And for the moment, we'll leave this issue then as it relates to 2087. The other remaining issue, not in the bill, is one that I broached in a general way at the last meeting, which was to try to build into the bill some kind of ongoing requirement that would compel the board to provide some reporting, record keeping and reporting vis-a-vis the assembly that would give us a improved database for understanding how the minimum mandatories, or rather minimum sentencing authority, is being used by judges, and how the board is using its authority dealing with overriding those and overriding consecutive sentences. Right now we are
Right now we're under a call.
Okay, we'll be back in a few minutes. Committee's in recess. Committee will return to order. So when we recessed, I was discussing again the notion of attempting to build into the bill some kind of reporting requirement that would compel the board to maintain data dealing with the use of minimum sentences. And the board's exercise of its authority to override minimums or set aside consecutives that would give the legislature a more elaborate basis for understanding, well, mainly for determining whether or not minimums are being used in a way that's producing minimums in conjunction with how the board is or isn't using its power to set aside, is producing discrepant treatment of similar cases. That's what we're trying to get to. And right now, we don't have the data, as I judge it, to be able to make that decision. We know how many minimums are being imposed by which judges, and what types of offenses, how many times the board is overriding. But we can't tell from the data we've got whether we're getting a markedly different and indefensibly different kind of treatment net of that whole process in similar cases. That we've got to get a handle on. So what I want to do is to draft language for the committee's consideration that's going to force the board to file reports with the legislature that will in turn compel them to keep data, perhaps in concert with the division that's going to tell us that.
Sure.
Got to know that somehow. Representative Lombard.
What, outside of the existing data that we do have, would you enumerate it? Because I'm puzzled as to what kind of data you envision would give us that information outside of a fairly complete case history of each case.
Well, I don't know whether you can get there short of that, Representative Lombard. That's a very good question. I guess I was assuming that there'd be some way short of a full explication of every case that would give us a handle on this problem.
Does the board make findings, or doesn't the board make findings now when they overturn a decision? Aren't those findings recorded?
Hazel, do you want to come up for a minute?
I think the information is available, is there. We have no way of retrieving it. We have no staff. Presently, we have 5 clerical staff.
Is the information there, do you have it on hard copy? Is that it, or in your computer?
No, we don't have any computer. The only access to computer that we have is through corrections. We have no way of retrieving anything.
So it's all written down on paper?
Yeah, on the BAFs, but we have no way of retrieving.
Are these standardized forms that have information on them, or is just every case kind of write down?
No, every case would be probably have its own.
Different.
Hazel, how many, just in volume, how many cases a year are you talking about where you are... where you're considering overturning a minimum mandatory?
Well, yeah, we prepared that information.
I know, I've seen a lot of your...
I didn't bring it with me today.
What was the last?
I have a rough estimate.
Representative, this is Rick McKenna, Carings Office of the Parole Board. I've been, was the one that was reviewing the data and the way it was processed. It's been going up. Here's that it's topped 1,000 last year in terms of the number
cases.
Of mandatories. I can't tell you out of how many cases that is. It's one of the questions that was asked here. We're trying to work out something. One of the problems we have, and you asked the question, how is the data assembled? It's put into the data processing system of the division. It comes back to you in thick block pages where you have to take that information apart. Once you've got the information, you can then put it into another computer and run some analysis of the data. And we have neither. All we get back are these printouts. And from that, laboriously you hand table all the information. We're to the point now where we can put that into a computer and begin asking the computer some questions. Can you give us a profile of this? But we're not there yet, nor do we have access ourselves to the computer. We have no money for that. We're totally dependent on somebody else to provide the service for us, in this case, the OPOP committee is agreeing and apparently quite willing for the next year or however often, or however long they're in operation. Help us with the data. The numbers are going up. The division's reported that to the committee. Those are our own observations as well.
Well, are you saying that OPOP is going to provide sufficient assistance?
We have not, at this point, we have not agreed. OPOP has not agreed how much they'll do, but they've said they're willing to help us. Of course, I would hate to see us be given a charge that we had to depend upon OPOP.
Oh, no, I'm not asking that. I'm asking whether informally you anticipate that you're likely, in conjunction with OPOP, to develop the kind of information I'm talking about terms of the next session.
I if it's my understanding, they have one more year OPOP's funded. And so I don't know that we could do that based on just OPOP.
Mr. Chair, I just almost think that it's more realistic to hope that something evolves there. You and I were discussing earlier, I might as well ask Hazel this. I had heard, and neither the chair nor I were clear about this, that there was either discussion or is in fact a provision in the bill out of Ways and Means to give you 2 additional parole board members but no additional staff. Is that correct?
No, that isn't correct. Okay. Ways and Means has suggested that we have 2 additional board members, and with that package, there would be 3 additional staff, 1 parole analyst, and 2 clerical specialists. And I doubt seriously that we could use a clerical specialist to retrieve that kind of information. And certainly we couldn't use the parole analyst, because the parole analyst would be needed to provide, to work on the caseload as a result of the Pendleton situation. That would absorb the analysts. And, of course, we presently need an additional hearing secretary, because we could have two panels going now if we had one more hearing secretary. So that would take care of that all right off the top. I envision the caseload that we get as a result of Pendleton, and with our present need for one more clerical person, that we would absorb the staff they're talking about.
I guess I have a real concern that it would be an empty charge from the standpoint. I'm just not sure that they have the capabilities right now to specifically time and personnel to develop a reporting model. And they don't have the computer capabilities to computerize it. So it seems to me that it would be a very intensive manual operation when you're talking over 1,000 cases a year. I guess I would almost suggest Chair write a letter to OPOP. And being part of OPOP, I guess, suggest that maybe they could help at least to the get the thing off the ground by developing a program or a model, a reporting model, which would then be integrated into a computer program that we could then look at in 2 years and say, take X number of dollars to set up this program. We consider it important to do so and proceed in that fashion.
Well, that's why I was asking about OPOP. It was in their assistance, there seems to be some prospect that by the next session we could at least have some perhaps recommended program or procedure in order to begin to collect them and have this data available. I'm not interested in making you do something you can't do. I don't think there's any prospect of getting any more money at this point. But somehow we've got to be able to get the information.
Sometimes. I would want to know this specifically what you wanted, and I'm sure you'd spell that out clearly.
I think it's important, Mr. Chair, to develop it. I just think that we may have to try to use that volunteer aspect on the side there, at least if OPOP is still available. Try to develop that.
I'll pursue the caption, see what he anticipates being happening there. Let's go back to our last item, which is the issue of findings. In the working draft of the bill, that issue is first raised. Section 16.
Excuse me, you say it's first raised? Where?
Well, maybe it's not first grade. I thought section 16 was where we began first to get into the...
I have it on page 2.
We've thrown all that out.
That's been discarded.
Thrown out.
Mr. Chair, let me throw up a matter of general policy.
Presumably, Mark.
That I'm mindful of both what Judges Hargraves and Mowbray were talking about, and listing all these several ones to the one of the major concerns seemed to be. It seems to me that at the very least, perhaps maybe this ought to be all we do this time. I don't know. But at the very least, we ought to perhaps require findings or reasons
be given in those cases where a minimum mandatory is imposed by the court that is in excess of the matrix. Right? No. Excess of the matrix. Now, my recollection is testimony indicated that there were some cases where the minimum mandatory was in fact within the matrix. A few, not very many, but some. And that there were a large number of cases that went to the parole board that had a minimum mandatory, little or no reasons were given. The board really had nothing to go on in making their judgment. And those were the cases most often overturned. Conversely, in those cases, and those judges, like Representative Guevara's judge, went to great detail in providing findings, reasons for exceeding the matrix, those cases were upheld. So it seems to me that at a very minimum, it would be good public policy to require findings in those cases.
So Wilmer?
Well, Wilmer's a little more to that. I agree with what